cure for it. Last night I was cured by some Bridport people with rough cider, brandy and Jägermeister. So bear with me. I'm going to talk about smuggling in Dorset, specifically in Dorset. Less about kind of technical aspects of smuggling, how it's carried out. More about concentrate on the motivations of the smugglers and what we think of the smugglers themselves. I've done this talk before and it was a lot longer, a lot of that information is in the pamphlet, so I'm going to try and keep it short today. What I want you to consider while I'm talking is sort of two themes running through, or two questions to bear in mind. The first question is, were smugglers in any way radical? Obviously, the radical history group, we're trying to approach it from a radical perspective. So try and bear in mind whether you think the things you're talking about, whether they were radical in any way. And the second one, whether we should be celebrating smugglers, whether they're heroes, or whether they are actually villains. And we'll touch on some of that in this. Now, just to give it a bit of context, sort of historical timeline that we're talking about with smuggling. Approximately 1700 to 1850. 1700, around that time when it, you know, started to really pick up smuggling and become a big deal. 1850 is when it pretty much started to peter out. And it started to peter out not because they managed to put smuggling down, but because they dropped tax off everything and smuggling was no longer profitable anymore. Also, you split that into two eras. You had what was known as the Golden Age, or the Golden Era, and it was golden for the smugglers because it was much easier in the Golden Era, much more open, a lot of people doing it, because the authorities were too busy fighting wars and they couldn't really put the resources in to deal with it. Post-Napoleonic Wars, when they had the resources to deal with it, we moved to the scientific age, and that was when people were getting caught more, so they had to sort of move to more cunning means to get around the authorities. You know, you had the Coast Guard come in, the Navy were more involved, so they had to be more subtle about it. Also, it was much more criminalised then, so you couldn't get caught, basically. Now, smuggling across England, you can make some generalisations, obviously, about what smuggling was about. But also, it was very specific to different areas, different things happen. Based on the sort of physical environment, the size of the community, the preventing forces that were in place, all gave smuggling a different flavour depending on where you were. So bear in mind, I am talking about Dorset, and what I'm talking about might not be true in other areas. One of the big differences was like between the west of England and the east of England. Now, in the east of England, you know, coming around Kent especially, was characterised by a lot of violence, like big, organised, violent gangs going around, so a lot of kind of terror, community. That didn't really happen in the West Country smuggling. And one reason that's given for that is that there was a lot more smuggling happening ahead of population. You know, everyone was involved in it, so actually you didn't need to terrorise the population because everyone was involved in it. Secondly, Dorset was a lot more remote, and so the preventive forces were tiny and people were spread out. So you didn't need to have the terror, but, you know, it was just going on and no one could deal with it. Also, you need to bear in mind that smuggling wasn't some kind of small scale enterprise going on, you know, it wasn't just a few white band man at the time going out and doing a bit. We're talking about massive scale smuggling, especially in Dorset. At some point it was like the largest economic activity actually going on in places, it was that big. Give an example, Paul, where I'm from, was nationally famous for being a smuggling town, that's what it was famous for across the country. When you bear in mind there were 9,000 people living there in 1801, it was quite a big town. So for that many people to be kind of famous for smuggling, you can see it was quite a big deal. In actual fact, Paul was known as the Devil's Paul, that was his nickname. And there was a little rhyme at the time that was known throughout the area about people from Paul. And it went, if Paul were a fish pool, and the men of Paul fish, there'd be a pool for the devil. Fish for his fish. So, the people of Paul were quite notorious. Now you might think, well, how could a town at that size, how could that many people be involved in smuggling? You know, surely you couldn't get that many people involved. But what you've got to think about is how you organise smuggling. So you have people that funded it, like the merchants, the squires, the innkeepers. You had the sailors actually, you know, bringing the stuff in. People spotting out the authorities, bringing the boats in, landing the stuff. The tubmen who actually carried it off the shore. And then you had the batmen, who were like the old security, the sort of bouncers, to make sure the smugglers were safe and the preventive forces would get beaten away. Then you have people who lent the horses, people who lent the storage space, hid the smugglers. Then of course people to sell the goods, and lots of people to buy the goods. They were all involved in the trade because they were buying the stuff. And then you've got all the people who, as the phrase goes, watched the wall while the gentleman went by. So even if you weren't involved in any way, as long as you kept quiet about it, you know, you were kind of involved. You just didn't inform, you didn't tell anyone, you know, allowed the trade to go on. So you read accounts of smuggling in Dorset, in the West Country, and it's very common for its height. A smuggling run would employ 200 to 300 people just on the shore itself to bring the boats in and get the stuff away. And a couple of hundred horses, which when you're talking about rural communities, coastal villages, that is a lot of people, you know, that's the whole village pretty much. And then of course the smuggling story continues, you know, pull right along the coast, and there's hardly anywhere in Dorset that's not somehow involved in smuggling, inland as well, because then the goods have to be taken to the big market towns, you know, like Dorchester, Salisbury, Winchester, even as far as Bristol and Bath, they've taken the goods. Interestingly, Bridport is actually one of the places that doesn't have as big a smuggling story. I mean, obviously, stuff went on, and at West Bay stuff went on, but it's not as big. And one reason given for that is, they say because Bridport had such a prosperous industry, i.e. the rope that was hanging people right across the world, they didn't need to smuggle because they had pretty much full employment and fairly high wages for the time, so there wasn't that incentive to go smuggling and risk getting caught. So, you know, hanging people is a good, prosperous economic activity. So to start to sort of evaluate smuggling and the smugglers, which is what we want to do, one way to do that is to kind of look at the official viewpoint, the official history viewpoint of smuggling from the establishment. Now, that really hasn't changed much over the last few hundred years. You know, smugglers in the official history have been kind of demonised. You know, they were lawless, immoral, violent, nasty people. So you read accounts from Parliament back in the day, and that's, you know, that's the way they would talk. In church, the smugglers were demonised, told, you know, you mustn't smuggle, you mustn't kind of collude with smugglers. And then in modern times, in kind of literature from the establishment, you know, books written about smuggling are generally written by ex-Navy captains, ex-customs men, people like that tend to write the main books. And what you get is this very like repetitive thing where the book will be about the nasty smugglers and the brave excise men. And nearly always, in the introduction, you basically get ordered not to side with the smugglers and not to romanticise it. I'm going to quickly read one of those out, because this gives you a flavour of the kind of introductions you get. This is from 1912, this book, called King's Cutters and Smugglers. It is such incidents as the above which knock all romance out of the smuggling incidents. An encounter with fisticuffs, a few hard blows, and an arrest after a smart chase or a daring artifice, whilst not lessening the guilt of smuggling, cannot take away our interest. Our sympathies all the time are with the revenue men, because they have on their side right, and in the long run, right must eventually conquer might. But as against this, the poorer classes in those days were depressed in ignorance with low ideals, and lacking many of the privileges which no thinking man today would refuse them. And because they were so daring and so persistent, because they had so much to lose, and comparatively speaking, so little really to gain, we extend to them a portion of our sympathy and a large measure of our interest. They were entirely in the wrong, but they had the right stuff in them for making the best kind of English sailormen, the men who helped to win our country's battles and to make her what she is today as the owner of a proud position in the world of nations. So it's pretty clear, smugglers bad,
Don't be on their side.
And as we've heard from Steve and Roger, the actual response to the smugglers and other forms of crime was unequivocal. And over time, smuggling was punished more and more harshly. You know, you start off, you could be fined, imprisoned, but then it would go into sort of impressment into the Navy, transportation, and eventually, people getting hung left, right and centre for smuggling. Even for associating with smugglers, because it was so out of hand, if you were helping a smuggler or you knew about a smuggler, this could happen to you as well. You know, it was taken that seriously. So why did the establishment feel this strongly? You know, why were people being strung up for what was basically, tax evasion was all it is. The main thing, obviously, is economic. The wars at the time, the empires that were being built, this massive expansion of the colonies and that, was almost entirely funded by taxes on goods. You know, that's how they managed to keep these wars going. So what you had, every time you smuggled something, it meant that there was no money going into the coffers to fight these wars and expand the empire. And at the same time, the money was going into France's coffers because you were paying for their stuff and then bringing it over. So there was a double thing going on. So it was really actually threatening the future of, this sort of nation state project. A few stats just to give you an idea. There was a parliamentary commission in 1783 which said that 300 English vessels were continuously involved in smuggling, and that didn't include East India men, postal smacks, fishing boats or foreign smacks. 300 ships, and that doesn't involve obviously all the part-time people that were just going out and doing it here and there, I swear. This is like full-time people. Also, between 1780 and 1783, £2 million of tea and 13 million gallons of brandy were smuggled into England in 3 years. And they estimated that £1 of tea was being smuggled for every ounce of duty was being paid for. So it was, it was rampant. There was pretty much every bit of tea, every bit of brandy that you could drink was smuggled. And there was genuine concern in expressed in Parliament that smuggling was actually going to bring the country down because we were going to lose the wars because we couldn't fund them. And England would just, fall apart. They also felt strongly, the establishment also felt strongly, because there was defiance of the law and the agency of the law from the smugglers. You know, it wasn't just about the economics, it was about what the people, were actually doing. And there was a sort of section of this, so you had at one end of the spectrum, you had just the kind of derision of the revenue men, and people just didn't care, they openly just, mocked them. Which is ostracising from the community. Nicknames people would sort of shout at them, they were called Philistines, land sharks, shingle pickers, and there was this sort of derision of the agents of the state. And then there was all these tales of, sort of famous local characters who would, outfox the authorities and make monkeys of them, and these people were famous and, kind of lauded. At the other end of the spectrum, obviously, you've got armed struggle against the state. You've got people fighting the revenue men. You've got people fighting the militia, the dragoons, coming out with weapons and winning. This is like just normal people getting together and taking on the sort of agents of the state. And that was a big deal. This is why they thought as well that the country was going to be brought down. So there's loads and loads of stories. You pick up smuggling books the smugglers winning battles on the shore. Or getting kind of beaten away, and they come back an hour later with more men and recapture what the revenue men have just taken. And then they send the revenue men back in. Occasionally, they would actually leave a consolation prize for the revenue men, just as a final kind of distance. Leave them a keg of brandy and say, sorry, we beat you. You also had effigy burning, threatening letters to the authorities. And generally, the smuggling communities have the upper hand over the state. You also had kind of economic empowerment of the poor, which was a big deal. People were really, really poor, especially when the wars would end, everyone would come back, surplus of labour, low prices. People were really poor, especially in rural areas. But you could earn more in one night of smuggling than you could in a week of labouring. One night, you could earn that money. You'd also get on top of that a hot meal, you know, you get a little bit of tea, a little bit of brandy. So, you know, the communities were actually being empowered by the smuggling. They were better off. There was also a really interesting kind of, I don't know, social political challenge. So, for example, the legal system, which these two guys talked about, it was completely built on the property class. It was there to defend them. Poor people didn't have the right, you know, to anything. The law was not in their interest. In Dorset, juries wouldn't actually convict smugglers. Poor people are smuggling. They wouldn't get convicted. They'd turn up. And no one would convict them because everyone was in on it. So you have these frustrating, you know, kind of judges and stuff. So why can't we convict these people clearly, openly smuggling? Because the people in the jury were part of it as well. So eventually, they took trials out of the town because they knew they couldn't convict smugglers in Dorset. But then eventually these got novelled because the smuggling went further in the towns. You know, next time on had an interest in it. So they did away with juries. And even more interestingly, just to show how much they subverted the legal process, the revenue officers themselves, who were like the main, you know, sort of agents of the state fighting smuggling, were a number of times convicted of murder when they, in the line of their duty, which is perfectly legal, happened to kill someone and trying to take it. They actually got tried and convicted of murder because the local communities were in charge of the legal process, and that's an incredible thing to consider. I would also argue that there was like a kind of cultural empowerment of poor people, in that they could now have the stuff that they could get stuff that was seen as luxury goods, you know. And so you could have tea, you could have brandy, you could have silks and things like this. There's no way that poor people should be allowed that, is there? Yet they could get this stuff. You had that kind of cultural empowerment, which the upper classes would not like, in the same way as I think today, you know, people don't like the lower classes wearing designer clothes or, you know, drinking champagne. That's not the way it's done. So overall, you know, the Dorset smugglers have kind of put themselves, you know, kind of empowered themselves. They were using their skills to better themselves. They were managing to avoid being exploited by the state, avoiding going into the Navy, which is one of the worst things that could end up happening to you. And they were, in fact, grudgingly admired by the state. Got a quote here, which I don't know if there's really time to read it out. How when they'd have these parliamentary commissions and stuff, there would be a speech about these are the bravest, most loyal people, that their knowledge is unbelievable, and they make the greatest sailors. It's just a shame you can't get them in our Navy, isn't it? Because they're too busy smuggling. So, next question then is, I mean, how much truth is there in the establishment's view? You know, the establishment say that these were violent people, they were violent towards the state institution, they were violent towards their communities, lawless and immoral. And, you know, maybe that's true, maybe we're wrong to celebrate. But if you put this in context, it soon kind of falls apart. I mean, violence against the community didn't really happen in Dorset and the West Country. Again, that was mainly a sort of East England thing. Because everyone was involved in it, you didn't need to, you know, kind of force people into smuggling, they wanted to be part of it. In actual fact, you read accounts of smuggling, and it's notable by its absence. There was no kind of violence towards the community. And I'm sure if it existed, you'd read about it. Violence against informers, that did happen. But again, it's very rare, the historical accounts, it's very rare that there was violence against informers, because most people weren't informing. When there was violence against informers, you can kind of understand where they were coming from, because the consequences of getting informed on getting caught were pretty serious. So roughing up an informer, I would say, is a, you know, a fairly reasonable thing to do. Violence against the state, you know, against the resident men. As Roger and Steve have pointed out, this was quite a violent age, and most of the violence that was being carried out in England and across the world at the time was being carried out by the state against the ordinary person. And I'd say that, you know, a few revenue men beaten up, or, you know, in some cases killed, is pretty insignificant when you compare that, you know, the horrors of being in prison, impressed, transported, hung, drawn and quartered. We need to keep that as the focus, that the, you know, that the violence of the age was not being carried out by people against the state, it was the other way around. And in terms of the whether it was illegal and immoral, the key there is to think about, well, whose law was it? And Steve obviously touched upon that earlier, that the law was created by a class of people to keep the other class of people in check. So when you talk about the legality of smuggling, you've got to think about whose law that was. Interesting dichotomy, which I'll talk a bit about, and that's customary right against law. So you have the law which was, you know, made by the state and the property classes. The lower classes, you had customary right, you know. That was their law, that was the poor person's law. And that had its own kind of morality to it. People felt that they had a right to eat, they had a right to goods like everyone else, and a right to genuinely free trade. And this customary right that people lived their lives by, not by the law. You only got to live by the law, because if you didn't, you might get hung, you know. What you lived your life by was your own rights that had been kind of handed down. And this custom had its own morality of, you know, kind of cooperation and solidarity within the community. So you see smugglers have been arrested, being rescued by the community. Hang people, smugglers hang, the community would come cutting down, you know. There was a genuine kind of solidarity within the communities. Also, smugglers paid fairly. People were paid very well to do it. There was insurance things as well. If you got injured in the run, you would actually get paid by the smugglers, you know, as compensation. And you don't see anything in the historical records about disputes over these things. You know, they were fair, and they worked very well. The important thing to consider really is that smuggling communities genuinely felt that what they were doing was right. They had a right to do this. They defended what, I mean, the title of the pamphlet, "We come for our own and we shall have it." You know, people genuinely felt, these are my goods, I bought them, I'll bring them in the country and sell them to someone else. You know, they didn't accept the king had a right to take his stuff back, or that, you know, had a right to tax them. Whose interests were the taxes themselves in? You know, why should people pay these taxes? You know, why would a poor person endorse it? That they wanted to pay the duty on this. What were the taxes going to? I mean, if you sort of had a, you could make an argument, you might not sort of agree, but you could make an argument that in the modern age, you should pay the taxes, because those taxes go towards the welfare state, they go towards your hospitals and your national insurance and stuff like that. But back then, that didn't exist. The taxes were used basically to fund wars. And who was going to fight in those wars? Oh, it's the people that are expected to pay the taxes. So there was no motivation, really, to pay the taxes at all. I've rattled on enough, I think, really. So two conclusions that I'll make from my perspective. The first conclusion I'll draw is that smugglers, I think, we can place them within the sort of radical pantheon. Now, they may not have been stated political radicals. They weren't levellers, they weren't diggers. I mean, even the pirates, a lot of the pirates had a kind of a sort of stated political agenda. The smugglers, I don't think, really had that. They were just getting on with it, you know, it was a sort of economic thing with a morality to it. But what they did do is they went up against the state and they won. And they created their own kind of alternatives, their own way of doing things, which was outside of the control. And I think that's radical within itself, and it's sort of an example for communities to look to, that you can actually do stuff yourself, you know. With strength of community. You know, they used their skills, they were resourceful, they were self-confident, and they cooperated with each other in the face of an extremely repressive kind of institution. You know, they managed to succeed for a long time to do that. So, which leads on to my second conclusion about whether we should celebrate smugglers or see them as villains. You know, if it's quite obvious that I think is we should be celebrating smugglers. You know, smugglers at the doorstep were people like me and you. You know, I don't think I would have been one of the landowners. I would have been one of the smugglers. And I see these as people that, you know, we would have been, and that's why we should celebrate them. The main thing, I think, if you're going to see them as a villain or a hero, it's whose idea of the law you take. You know, do you see the law as a kind of neutral, natural force that we should all just kind of believe in? Or do you see it as something that was constructed against people like the smugglers? And do you believe in law, or do you believe in the kind of customary right that people handed down through generations? And personally, I'm on the latter side. Before I finish, obviously something I haven't done today is kind of go into any of the really great stories that are out there. You know, there's some incredible characters, you know, in the history of Dorset smuggling and English smuggling. Incredible stories, some great legendary feats, the things people did to get away with it, some of the tricks they used, some of the ways they outfoxed the revenue. Make unbelievable reading. I mean, some of it you just couldn't make fantastic. So what I encourage everyone to do is get out there and pick up some good books on smuggling and read some of the stuff that went on in Dorset, and I think you'll probably be quite proud of the stuff that went on. That's it. Come on.
What people actually think, you know, it's, that's despite being top of the
players
of the I mean, a lot of what you're saying, and if you look at stuff like footballers, pop stars, they're all that you think about as a celebrity now. These things we hear about, it's ordinary people who do it. Like, ordinary people who find a famous footballer, ordinary people who become like celebrities now, ordinary people who become pop stars. And pirates, why they're popular at this moment, it's because they're ordinary people. I mean, every city pirate was sailors. They were sailors. That's what they were. They were the maritime workers. Yeah. Basically, they were flying and people would come around bosses. So people felt like, that, you know, these people are those difficult figures. They were much closer to them than, say, you know, Lord Sir Fellow with Quentin Benjamin and
that. But it's true, the consciousness right for them is to actively target associates.
Yeah.
And they've been very controlled for their own, especially the higher people. Overboard they go. And they've let the slaves out, and the ones that were fit enough or wanted to were joined. And in fact, many of the pirate crews that were in the Caribbean in the sort of late 17th, 18th century had a large amount of black slaves. But black pirates are the highest value in the form of slaves because they were fighting the death. So they were definitely not retained alive. So those, if you watch Disney stuff, you see black pirates and crews and stuff. That's kind of a little message of Disney films, or you see this, and in books you see black pirates, and that's true. It's true, that's what happened. They're highly valued as lots of pirates. So, there's a whole load of stuff about the multinational nature and crews and that's going on now. But it's
super. It's interesting you mentioned Cromwell in Ireland.
Yes.
Are you aware thousands of Irish soldiers came to Dorset in 1644-45 doing exactly here what Cromwell was alleged to have done overnight?
Well, that's what I
they raped and pillaged their way through Dorset. To bring up, it's like slave trade. There was a black slave trade and white people. 400 years after
wars,
you choose your history.
Before white transatlantic slave trade, there was an African slave trade. There were a lot of Africans to get as well. But actually, the slaves that were taken off the war and captured in several wars in Africa anyway. And it perpetuated the history of one of the biggest slaves of African nations. But then circumstances guns and going in the ranks that comes up. But no, I didn't know about that in Dorset. But the thing is, I mean, some of the stories look upon the English Civil War, the British Civil War, whatever you want to call it, as part of the wider European Confederation that occurred years later, when there was mercenaries on the religious sites, and even so, Protestants or Catholic Ireland, they came or vice versa. They played by some great parts of Germany, and Ireland was part of that. Well, I'm surprised to hear it from you,
I don't really know that, but I saw it in the I think it's interesting that, you know, the story maker here probably correctly, but their gang of boys burned down a bar or something, and one of them got caught for it, and took that, and he was only 15, and he was sentenced to execution, which gives you an idea, I think, of the brutality, probably about 1833. And quite late in 19th century, but the laws were brought in 18th century were still there. Before kid gets hung with roof. I believe 2,000 people, is that right,
Chief?
2,000 people came out of the town. And I think, you know, again, it's that in itself is an example of the community, you know, showing that these public executions, you know, was not acceptable. And so again, it's turned on its head. So there's another example of Britain itself being like people reacting to the brutality of the capitalists. And, you know, the kind of punishment at the time. And I think that, you know, that's an interesting example of Ripple, you know, it's a sad example as well. I think even sadly, you know, poor kid, they had to, weights on the
window.
So,
yeah.
Example here, as he's been served, it's interesting to look, I'm interested to find out what that crowd said. What was that crowd, 2,000 people there, what was their reaction to it? That's the interesting bit, that's the mass social response, so we're interested in. Not just the legal, you go to the court case, yeah, there's a working to try to do it, but the key thing isn't written down a lot of the time, it isn't written into history, not the legal record, is what did those 2,000 people think? What did they think in the town? What was their reaction to it? And that's the hard bit to get that history. Why socialism is difficult, but there's examples of work to be done there, I should imagine, in this town. Well, not the least, so we're not looking for a bad thing, but we're looking at what other people really think about it, how do they feel about it, how do they protest. So there's a working point. Yeah, that's it. So we're going to do some